Well, we come now to our second session, and it's a really great pleasure to introduce Lawrence Foss to you. Now, Lawrence, in fact, won the Network Book Prize in about 2002, and it was entitled The End of Modern Medicine. We're extremely lucky having Lawrence with us today. He lives in California. Which of you is going to leave California to come here to the UK? But at any rate, we have him here. And he was brought up in an army family, so he traveled a lot. And children that travel in their childhood like that make exceptional people. They tend to break disciplinary rules, and they tend to think outside the box. And this is exactly what Lawrence has done, a very creative person. And his book, The End of Modern Medicine, is one which I would recommend to you all. He spent a lot of his life in Detroit and was asked to set up community colleges, and he recognized straight away that the people in the colleges had, particularly I had the black population, because I think it's something like 75-85% black people in Detroit, have enormous social skills, but of course very little intellectual skills because they have missed out on their education. And he pointed out that it's unusual in our culture for a lecturer to stop his lecture and welcome somebody who's late in, and for people who are listening to make room for it, but this is absolutely normal in the black cultures that he was dealing with. So it's a really a great pleasure for you to be here, it's a great pleasure for us to have you here. And you might ask the question, what is Lawrence doing in the network? Why did he come here? And this is a really good question for us at this time in our evolution, because the reason he's here is through Network. And in fact, Lawrence saw a copy of Network and recognized that there was something really interesting going on, and that was David Lorimer's reviews. Because David's reviews, 40 reviews or 25 reviews or however many they are, different books per issue, with fundamental insights, meant that what we were really dealing with was an organization which is different and tended to think outside the box. So, Lawrence, it's really nice to have you here. And we're so pleased that you've given up California, even if only for a little bit. And you're going to talk to us today about a new era of complexity for the 21st century. So thank you so much, Lawrence.
Thank you, Peter. I said to Peter earlier that, and I am particularly pleased to be here today because when I first heard about the Scientific and Medical Network through the journal, I thought, I don't see how in today's world where I was from, it could survive with a motif of combining science and spirituality. What a beautiful juxtaposition. And then with an editor that seemed to be inexhaustible energy with as many reviews as he would do per issue, and sort of keep one abreast of what was going on, because his, that many reviews, he still made very insightful comments. Because of the institutional heft of the entity that I'll be critiquing today, modern science and its philosophical foundations, I made an effort to weave my argument as tightly as possible, And so, with your indulgence, rather than trying to ad lib it with the facility that Vasilios, who I'm mad at, for being that good, I'm going to read from the argument, if you will indulge me, as I say. The story begins shortly before the middle of the 17th century and after the publication of Descartes' widely influential scientific writings. By then, according to science historian Thomas Kuhn, most physical scientists came to assume that ours was a corpuscular universe, one in which all natural phenomena could be explained in terms of corpuscular shape, size, motion, and interaction. Over the next 3.5 centuries, the concept of corpuscle would undergo considerable sophistication and precision, but the template was set. The corpuscular conception of the universe told scientists what sorts of questions to ask and what many of their research problems should be. For Kuhn, this nexus of commitments proved to be both metaphysical and methodological. As metaphysical, it told scientists what sort of entities the universe did and did not contain. There was only shaped matter in motion. As methodological, it told them what ultimate laws and fundamental explanations must be like. Laws must specify corpuscular motion and interaction. An explanation must reduce any natural phenomenon to corpuscular action under these laws. This nexus of commitments underlies today's prevailing scientific philosophy. Call it the principle of the closeness of the physical domain. Theologian philosopher Philip Clayton describes this philosophy. Reality, he says, consists of fundamental material particles. These basic particles, together with the forces that act upon them, determine the behavior of all objects in the world. All else is built up out of these constituents. All causal arrows point upward from the fundamental microphysical causes, all causal arrows point upward from the fundamental microphysical causes, and all explanatory arrows point downward. Against this backdrop, Oxford physicist Roger Penrose observes, "Science seems to have driven us to accept that we are all merely small bits of a world governed in full detail, even if perhaps ultimately just probabilistically, by very precise mathematical laws. Our brains themselves, which seem to control all our actions, are also ruled by these same precise laws." Here, the poet gets it right. Who is ridden with a conscience worries about a lot of nonsense. Echoing a consensus of fellow Nobelist scientists when they exchanged their lab coat for their philosophical hat, physicist Steven Weinberg speaks of, quote, "the discovery going back to the work of Newton that nature is strictly governed by impersonal mathematical laws." Physicist Murray Gell-Mann makes this point more casually. Life, he says, can perfectly well emerge from the laws of physics plus accidents, and mind from neurobiology. It is not necessary to assume additional mechanisms or hidden causes, he adds. The logic of this scientific philosophy is that by allowing for the possibility that some causal arrows point downward or some explanatory arrows point upward, we compromise science's ontologically reductionist program. This would open the door to the possibility that mindful intelligences like us could subvert the direction of these arrows, so undermining the legitimacy of the claim for the universality of the laws of nature. Suppose we were permitted to say that such intelligences can sometimes freely choose to go to the fountain to get a drink of water. There exists no mathematical equations that explain such a trip. Today's neurobiology doesn't explain it. It describes some of the operative neurophysiological mechanisms by which it might occur. Yet, to permit such a proposition would be to subvert the methodology that has underwritten modern science from the start. Permitting purposeful behavior would violate the worldview of this science. Cognitive scientist Steven Pinker expresses this worldview when he says, quote, "The facts of science expose the absence of purpose in the laws governing the universe. We have only to look at the successes both of today's particle physics and astrophysics and their commitment to the universality of their natural laws to assess the cost of denying such a proposition. It seems a small price to pay for these astonishing successes." To get a fuller understanding of this price, consider for a moment an alternative scenario that calls for additional mechanisms or hidden causes, one not compatible with the idea that we are governed by very precise mathematical laws. Within the last century, we have learned to engineer and re-engineer our own naturally selected genetic code, and that of other species as well. Step by step, we have begun to make over ourselves and our terrestrial environment. Lately, this has come to include our extraterrestrial environment. Theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman tells this story. Americans, fearful of Sputnik, landed men en masse on the moon. Parting, they left mass. Changing the orbital dynamics of the solar system and beyond. A cultural decision serves as a causal agent in altering a natural process. Each successive step poses a further threat to the reign of the principle of the closeness of the physical domain. Given such a scenario, we could speak of today's physics as a study not of universal, timeless laws, but of current tendencies of nature. It is not surprising that for the scientizer, all intelligibility must come down, be reduced to scientific intelligibility. This identification of scientific intelligibility with the principle of the closeness of the physical domain, whereby the activities of people, culture, are immaterial to the evolutionary dynamics of the universe, nature defines culture-nature dualism. This dualism can be encapsulated as follows. If nature can impact culture, the relationship is not symmetric. Culture cannot causally impact nature. Nature speaks, culture listens. Recognition of this quasi-metaphysical network of commitments, call it a meta-narrative, is significant only so far as it is accompanied by the credible possibility of a counter-meta-narrative, culture-nature interactionism. Increasingly, the natural world is a joint product of cultural and natural forces. Not only are we observers of nature, more and more we become agents of its change. In this model, causal arrows point both upward and downward. Likewise, explanatory arrows point in either direction. Nature talks, culture listens, and talks back. This is an historical observation. Throughout the prior history of Western civilization, this alternative had been impractical and untested. From the beginning, our civilization had been understandably rooted in culture-nature dualism. From the earliest days of finding ourselves on the planet, we had little choice but to erect protective shelters for withstanding the powerful forces of nature. How could we have contemplated a world in which our small clan, tribe, village, culture might wrest some control from these forces? We had to invent Titans, Prometheus, who would on our behalf steal fire from the gods, thereby sending us on our independent course. Clearly, the universe was governed by sovereign laws, or gods, beyond our dominion. When philosophy took hold in the first millennium BCE, this was the received story, and it has remained essentially intact over the ensuing two millennia. Plato memorably crystallized this story in his myth of the cave. Humans huddling in the cave, culture, watching the flickering shadows on the wall enacting the events of the outside world. Nature. In one form or other, this myth reenacted the common assumption of Western dualist thinking for the next two millennia. Nature spoke, culture listened. In this context, Whitehead's often repeated comment that the philosophy of the past 2,000 years can be understood as footnotes to Plato gains credibility. The myth infuses our Western concepts, both of art and science, as well as our sense of what it is to be human. That this has been our standard background myth becomes clearer when contrasting it with culture-nature interactionism. According to this alternative myth, now wielding a blue guitar, coming of age in the Milky Way, cave dwellers rise, turn, and depart the cave for the vast spaces outside. Interacting with these spaces, they learn to navigate their way about them to their purposes, remaking the sea whose song they sing. In the course of defending themselves against the remorseless forces of nature, through the combination of intelligence and an opposable thumb an unexpected event transpires. They evolve ways of leveraging these forces to their ends. Here is the basis for a successor meta-narrative. Our stone tools morph into earth refashioning instruments like steam engines, nuclear reactors, and gene splicing methodologies, enabling us to subdue nature locally. Moreover, there seem no logical limits to what counts as local. In the dualist meta-narrative, humans are finally extraneous to the unfolding of the universe. If they can come to understand the laws governing its dynamics, they have no role in the playing out of these dynamics. For all nature cares, they are momentary cosmic accidents orbiting, quoting here, a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet orbiting around a very average star in the outer suburb of one among 100 billion galaxies. A quote from Stephen Hawking. I understand his wife had a problem with his definition. It has a way of depersonalizing one rather quickly. Contrary to some claims made for it, quantum mechanics doesn't change this story. If the experimenter alters the subsequent quantum evolution of the system, he has no sustained intentional control over the direction this evolution takes. By contrast, in the interactionist meta-narrative, mindful intelligences like ourselves are understood not only as interested observers, but as active collaborators in natural change. From an interactionist perspective, a dualist philosophy of science is seen to be historically short-sighted. Consider the previous claim that not only are we observers of the natural world, but agents of its change. In his book on the rise of complexity in nature, cosmologist Eric Chason quotes some long-forgotten wit, "Hydrogen is a light, odorless gas, which, given enough time, changes into people." These changes comprise the history of cosmic evolution, the sum total of all the many varied changes in the assembly and composition of radiation, matter, and life throughout the history of the universe. They are changes that produced our galaxy, our sun, our earth, and ourselves. These ourselves make up those of us who, over the past 400 years, by virtue of first studying these changes scientifically, then technologically applying this knowledge to our ends, have begun causally to impact our galaxy, sun, earth, and ourselves. Through the agency of today's cultured and technological civilization, we are creating hybrids of ourselves and of other species. By means of recombinatory genomics, we have learned to bioengineer our genome. We can move individual genes from one organism into another, as when we transplant a gene from an Arctic flounder into tomatoes to create frost-resistant tomatoes. We are learning to concoct lab genes from scratch, stitch them into a set of genetic instructions, and implant the new code into an organism, making cells that can hatch new things. things nature hasn't seen before. Thus do we leapfrog the naturally selected lineage about which Darwin taught us. The resulting genotypes are what Darwin, when speaking parenthetically in the first chapter of The Origin, of the plant and animal breeders he admired, called methodically selected hybrids of that lineage, our creations. The key is man's power of accumulative selection, quoting from Darwin. Nature gives successive variations. Man adds them up in ways useful to him. He generates hybrid worlds. At another level, as a result of our human presence and the collective choices we make, we are materially altering the chemical composition of the Earth's lithosphere, hydrosphere, and atmosphere. Already we have punctured the ozone layer. Beyond this border, we have walked on the moon, so altering its physical contours. Through our rover landings, we are seeking to terraform Mars, precipitating a possible second interplanetary agricultural revolution. Explorer 1 recently entered interstellar space. Measured cosmologically, it is a very short period of time. Ours has become an ever-expanding footprint. Nor does there seem to be a logical limit to the reach of this footprint. Just as significant, the changes cited are irreversible. The persistence of their effects does not depend on the continued existence of our species. Part of nature's evolutionary dynamics, once initiated, these effects reverberate indefinitely throughout the cosmos. Already, we are agents of cosmic change, embedded in nature's fabric. This is a different scenario than that with which we grew up. This is a different scenario from that with which we grew up. It bespeaks a change in the way evolution evolves from unconscious and natural to conscious and methodical. The dawn of the second great transformation in all of history, Eric Chason calls it. After the brief primordial era when radiation prevailed, for the next 10 billion years, matter dominated all physical changes in the universe. The matter era, it was one in which all causal outcomes can be attributed to a series of connected events, each of which pertains to a physical modality. Thus, the flow of heat from the center of interstellar clouds produces the energy needed for forming stars. Heat flow, energy, stars. The causal chain is all of the same material modality, so the causal arrows all point upward and explanatory arrows point downward. With the advent of the life era 3 billion years ago, the same energy obtained for biophysical events. Thus, the natural selection of a population's life forms with advantageous traits adapt to a changing environment and pass on to their descendants these traits. Again, advantageous traits, adaption to a new environment, new traits, physical modalities all. Our scientific methodology is thereby eminently suited for explaining such events In each of them, cause allows, as I said, point upward and explanatory arrows downward. The causal closeness of the biophysical domain remains intact, ontological reductionism. To the extent that these events persist throughout the present era, this methodology retains its efficacy today. Within our lifetime, alongside these eras, another era has come into visibility. That signaled by events like those just identified. These events remind us that we live also amidst the emergence of a fourth era. Call it the mind or culture era. It is symbolized by the earlier story about a change in the orbital dynamics of the solar system. From proceeding unconsciously and naturally, evolution now evidently proceeds also consciously or purposefully. This fact is quite extraordinary. Still unexplained is the emergence of self-aware mindfulness in the universe. The nature of evolution itself changes. Chaisson calls this a transformation of astronomical significance, an event of space-time when technological life forms begin manipulating matter more than matter influences life, much as matter eventually came to dominate radiation earlier in the universe. This transformation weaves aesthetic and technological intelligences like ourselves into the fabric of universal evolution. Such is the significance of shifting from a dualist to an interactionist meta-narrative. One is predicated on the idea of a nature that exists independently of culture and people, the other is not. Referencing an observation by physicist David Deutsch, philosopher Barry Dayton wonders aloud whether our familiar construal of the Copernican revolution is misguided. It may well be, he says, that there is nothing more significant than us in the entire universe. By contrast, physicist Alan Guth says reality exists independently of people. The goal of physics is to understand that reality. But if we are to accept the adage that to have causal powers is to be real, the reality that today's physics tracks is but a partial reality. And the goal it sets for itself to understand all reality is short-circuited. Taking the interactionist turn affords a more robust vocabulary. One can entertain alternative meta-narratives. Cosmologist Brian Swim speaks of a graduated historical shift from an unconscious one-dimensional to a conscious bi-dimensional universe. Stars evolved for billions of years with no human consciousness involved, he says, and yet now these same fusion processes are understood and activated by human consciousness and expertise. Genetic mutations proceeded for 4 billion years outside of human consciousness, but now alterations in the gene are being carried out within the human project. For billions of years, natural selection organized the evolutionary processes of the Earth. But now, this unconscious natural selection is being supplemented by a conscious selection. A vast number of species now evolve under pressures by conscious human decisions. These historical developments illustrate how evolutionary dynamics can themselves evolve. they can evolve seamlessly from unconscious material, atomic, and biological genetic to conscious technological mimetic processes. Stated simply, where for 13 billion years evolutionary dynamics proceeded in a largely unconscious manner, now, with the human, these same dynamics are unfolding within conscious self-awareness. The dynamic of cosmogenesis shifts from the unconscious movement of masses and electric charges to include conscious decisions as to how to steer this movement. In order to account for this directive role of mind, our vocabulary needs a configuration space sufficiently inclusive to permit culture-nature conversation, a steerer and a steered. A thought experiment by Deutsch maps this space. He asks us to imagine a future civilization on Earth with the knowledge to modify the dynamics of the solar system on a grand scale. Perhaps this civilization wishes to use its knowledge of astrophysics to prolong the lifetime of the sun by altering its composition in some way. Now, the evolution of the stars, like the sun, is already well understood, and the properties of an aging sun can be determined rather precisely by the application of the standard laws of nuclear and plasma physics. An alien observer on the far side of the galaxy, who modeled the behavior of our sun in this manner, would fail to find agreement with observations because the sun would have been altered by the scientific knowledge of the terrestrial civilization. In this case, knowledge has an impact big enough to rival the standard processes of astrophysics, such as the flow of heat from a stellar star. One implication is that our current astrophysical laws are not, after all, entirely predictive, nor are they universal. They omit a significant agency of change, mindfulness, an agency not readily responsive to a set of mathematical equations. At the moment, this scale of cosmic engineering is still the stuff of science fiction. Yet, on its face, it is just an extension of the cosmic engineering of the way we have already modified the terrestrial and extraterrestrial environments, modifications that just a century ago would themselves have been the stuff of science fiction. And we can all think of novels written very close to here, I think, about some of those science fiction predictions. There is no reason, Davies concludes, that life and mind cannot, over eons, transform the nature of the universe on a very large scale. The particular terminology, mindfulness, purposefulness, teleological, intentionality, singularity, is not important. Important is whether our science has a vocabulary rich enough to speak of phenomena like that projected by such a thought experiment. Interactive state physics thus serves to amplify the vocabulary of physics by an order of magnitude. Interactive state physics is the kind of physics we have to develop to explain this change in the nature of evolution. It supplements solid state physics, you might say. Atomic, nuclear, and solid state physics. Mindful causal agency, like that exercised by aesthetic and technically competent beings, no longer is simply a philosophical concept, like free will. if to have causal power is to be real, such an agency is a scientific concept, for the same reason that matter and energy are scientific concepts. By moving matter and energy, it can change nature. In this meta-narrative, causal arrows can point either upward or downward. Likewise, explanatory arrows can point in either direction. In this way, it meets the minimum requirements for being a scientific concept. Deutsch describes the sequence of these requirements. First, we postulate a new theory to explain some class of phenomena, and then we perform a crucial experimental test, an experiment for which the old theory predicts one observable outcome and the new theory another. One then rejects the theory whose predictions turn out to be false. A physics that overlooks this agency is a physics whose explanatory reach is short-circuited in ways suggested by the passage quoted from Swim. In retrospect, today's modern physics is now seen as logically equivalent to an indispensable formal subset of a more comprehensive physics. Interactionism explains all that the dualistic predecessor explains, plus, at least, some of what it does not. Here is the new story of complexity for the 21st century.
Lawrence, thank you so much for that. That's a wonderful description, very, very tightly told, and leads us to the conclusion that, in fact, mind has a place in the universe, and so complexity clearly is for the 21st century. So thank you very much, Lawrence, for that.
Thank you.
I would also like to welcome Joan here, Lawrence's wife. Where's Joan? There. Joan is an intensive care nurse, works with cardiac arrests, and obviously this is of enormous interest to me because we have in common near-death experiences. So, Joan, you're very welcome here.
Thank you.
Now, let me suggest that we have 5 minutes of you talking to each other, and then we can take the questions for Lawrence, and then we'll have a dialogue between them and a dialogue between you and the speakers. Who's going to ask the first question? Oh, Bernard will. But Bernard, just before you do, I've just had a fascinating discussion with Lawrence, very privileged, because I could ask all my questions immediately. And quite clearly, the second Big Bang, or the introduction of mind into the universe, is absolutely crucial. And our discussion ranged from the question of placebo, why placebo alters effects, and the cultural effect on medicine and the cultural effect on society as a whole. Okay, Bernard.
Lawrence, first of all, I love the idea of the second Big Bang. Since I spent most of my life studying the first Big Bang, I'm even more excited by the second Big Bang. But I wanted to ask you a question about the relationship between mind and brain, because one of the issues which is of great interest to, I guess, people here, is whether mind is just an epiphenomena, consciousness is just an epiphenomena of the brain, or whether consciousness is somehow precedes the brain, so you have a sort of filter theory in which consciousness is merely sort of observing the world through the brain. And what I found interesting about your description is it looks as though it could go either way. You could either be interpreting mind as being emergent from the brain and as thereby playing a role in evolution, or you could take a view that in some sense mind is actually, the bigger mind is there all along, and the bigger mind is affecting its environment through lots of brains, just as an individual brain does. So what is your own perspective on that problem? Are you a filter theorist, or are you a sort of epiphenomenalist?
Thanks for the question. My answer might be oversimplified, but I, having had a unnameable background in philosophy, degree in philosophy, I found it's much easier. All I'm interested in this context is to distinguish between a steerer and a steered. And so for these purposes, all you need to do is distinguish between the fact that some phenomena result from a steerer steering matter and energy, and that steerer you can call whatever you choose to, but it's of a different ontological level, you could say, from the steered. And if you look at the dictionary definition of physics, you find that they don't have a vocabulary for making that distinction. I mean, just looking at the first reality consists of fundamental material particles, together with the forces that act upon them, determine the behavior of all objects of the world. So physics commits itself to saying we want to identify the forces that are responsible for the behavior of all the objects in the world. And they can't, in the case of the examples that were given of, just the recombinatory genomics, or even Darwin's plant and animal breeders, which he so admired, they were making choices about what hybrids they wanted to produce, and those hybrids were new to nature, and it was as a result of a choice, a steerer steering the materials needed to make the hybrid. And so in that way I've been able to at least deflect those philosophers that come in and say, well, is it mind or brain or
so it's a question of steerer with a big S or steerer with a little S.
It's a vocabulary problem. It's not a ontological problem.
Okay, Jackie. Oh, okay. You've got it.
I've been thinking about these sort of ideas for a number of years now, and I was asked a question by somebody about the purpose of mind, and the answer I came up with, and I don't know what you might think of this, is that if the evolution of the mind in the universe has come about in the way it has, is this actually possibly to reverse entropy?
Basilios?
give Basilios a microphone, would you?
I was just thinking about that. The short answer is yes, because this kind of mind that Lawrence is introducing is opening the system. So we are in an open system anyway. We are not part of the dominion of the entropy increase forever. The steerer does decrease entropy, that's for sure.
Okay, Marilyn.
Hi, I'm over here.
Hi.
I'm wondering how important humans are in the scheme of things and how important human mind is. As far as we know, life has only happened once. Was that 3 billion years ago or so? And it's not happened again. And all life forms, from plants, animals, and have just come from that original replicating DNA molecule. And and scientists with all their skills have not been able to, synthetic biologists have not been able to do that again, and it hasn't happened again. And in a way, humans are really, compared with other animal species, are quite defective in terms of their sensory awareness. And, you know, what we are good at is predicting experiences from the past into the future in order to rapidly manipulate and exploit the circumstances for our survival. And like other 99% of species, you know, we're bound to undergo mass extinction at some point. And in fact, humans, in terms of DNA sequence and so on, we're just a twig on the evolutionary tree. And I really don't see it, human beings, as being some sort of pinnacle and human mind directing the future of the cosmos. Yeah, well, I think that's all that I was going to say. I mean, in terms of human culture influencing, leaving some matter on the moon, or Explorer 1 going into interstellar space, I mean, sure. I mean, in terms of the butterfly flapping its wings, it reverberates, everything we do reverberates throughout the universe. But these effects, aren't they rather minuscule on the cosmos? I mean, that's just a thought.
Yeah, if I understand, I mean, that, I guess I have two, when you say minuscule, example of changing nature, is that what you meant, that the examples given were, in terms of the entire universe, are pretty minuscule and don't add up maybe to the ability to be an agent of natural change, that humans are, the point here was that humans are, have become, humans are agents of natural change, and that was simply not, it was not even, there wasn't evidence enough, even in 1600s when the methodology was evolved, to think that we could actually, we could change things on the earth. They knew that, but they didn't know that, they didn't suspect that this could be expanded. I mean, we had never gone into, Mars, and that's a small step, you know, you say, for mankind, but or going to the moon. But it's indicative of the extent to which over, if we have in the next 14 billion years, matter's had 14 billion years to evolve what we, and we've had 200,000 years at most with Homo sapiens. And so the discrepancy is enormous. Between the results that we've achieved in terms of changing the universe, not changing, but participating in the evolution of the universe, that I might be missing your point there, but I have another. Let me see if I'm askew here.
Microphone for Marilyn. Yeah.
Well, I acknowledge that human technological explosion and human interventions with nature and so on are going to have huge effects on our planet. Huge. I just don't know how much they're going to affect the cosmos.
Well, isn't it just a question of extrapolation? I mean, can you give me 14 billion years to answer, you know, to come in with an answer?
And
but I like very much your example of leaving mass on the moon, so changing its orbit, yeah, and so changing the universe. Yes. I thought that was really nice. Okay, small to begin with, grow later. Tuvi.
Jackie's been waiting.
Thank you.
Okay, Jackie.
Yes. In your answer to Bernard's question,
Yes. In your answer to Bernard's question, you used the word deflect. And I want to say that I found in your very clear description of the complexification of the universe over 13 billion years, nothing that you said would not have been acceptable to reductionist scientists. And that, of course, is good because it gives a common dialogue. But I want to ask you a very basic question. Is it possible that before the emergence of complex, intelligent life within the universe, that there could have been at work an aspect of matter, if you like, that we would understand as mind, and that was in effect a causative agent from the very beginning? That is my question.
It was in the original initial plan. Is that?
No, I didn't use the word plan. I want to take your kind of descriptive term, but to say whether there could have been a causative agent of a non-basic physical material kind at work from the beginning, something we would understand as a rudimentary aspect of mind, something that emerges and, in a sense, guides the emergence of mind. Could there have been any agent at work of a causative nature of that kind? That's my question to you.
It's a deep question, so I'm not sure I'm going to give you a satisfactory answer, but when you think we now have cosmologically, we have a chain of knowledge taking us from primal energy at the time of the period of the radiation era all the way. We can take it step by step. From primal energy came elementary particles evolved into atoms, atoms evolved into galaxies, stars. Stars gave us heavy elements. The heavy elements provided the biological structures that eventually came to, into life forms, and then life forms advanced in ways that led to higher life forms and to intelligence, and intelligence led to cultured and technological civilization that we share now. So is it fair to say that the cosmologists can now map the evolution of cosmogenesis in a way which makes sense of our present situation, sitting here able to talk about the cosmos that we originated from, were born out of, or were born into? Is that?
Well, I just really wanted to know if you agreed fundamentally with, for example, Stephen Hawking, that there's nothing outside of our universe and that there's nothing within it that is other than the basic physical structure that everybody agrees is there. It's a case of whether that is all there is. I wanted to know if that is part of your understanding of the nature of our reality.
How do you feel about... How do you feel about the idea that primal energy already contained the seeds of what we now experience?
Yes, that's what I really wanted to know. In fact, did primal energy in some way have an aspect, that's all I would call it, that is what we understand as mental, as something just beyond the pure physical mass?
I mean, I guess that comes down to... I feel like David asked for a short biop when submitting something, in an article, and what our interests are, and as some said, running, and And some said, I don't know, Tennessee. And I was trying to think, and I thought, well, I feel like I'm inbred into the universe. I mean, I just feel like, I mean, how else? I can't explain why. I'm inbred, and I'm at home in the universe because I'm bred into it. And that seems to me that anybody who doesn't feel that way just feels different. It might be come down to a feeling mode, but I remember some philosopher, I wish I remember the name of the books, said, what do you think of atheism? And he said, well, I don't know enough to be an atheist. You know?
That's a wonderful answer. Could I just put the question another way? People have described, for example, the operations of a beehive and how it appears to be a kind of collective intelligence where the bees, for example, they're going to find a new home and they describe the distance and the nature of a potential new home through a form of communication we would call dance. Now, we see this collective intelligence at work, and enough research has been done that scientists can describe how this works, but without ascribing an overall collective purposeful intelligence. So they deprive it, if you like, of that possible dimension. So what I'm really asking you about the complex universe that we observe is whether the how is enough or whether there might possibly be a why.
Great question. I mean, I had to study Thomistic theology at one time, and that's the sort of question that is continually circulating in that kind of environment. So, I mean, I think we're getting, I mean, and I can't discount it, but I don't have the, I can give, you know, who know, I mean, there's something phenomenal, it seems to me, about people asking questions like this. We're part of the universe, and these questions are being asked, so they signify something about the universe in which we find ourselves asking these questions. Where do you go, you know, from here? From there, to how do you?
Yes. I don't know. I understand you. I think even the reductionist
I think
stand in all.
Again, have to move on. Thanks, Jackie.
My question was a bit very, very similar, but I want to make it very, very clear. Do you believe that all this process, the first Big Bang, was, you mentioned, unconscious process, and only now the second Big Bang started to be conscious? Do you think there was any purpose in this universe, or there is no purpose? We were created ourselves by random situation, or there was a purpose plan or purpose thing that evolved? Is there a purpose and intelligence in all this process until the human being are involved?
I would argue that the first scientific revolution, I date from 1600 to 1950, is subsumed as a special case of a larger second scientific revolution, which incorporates everything that the first revolution informed us about, and something else besides. So it's logically speaking, it's a subset of a larger set. And then when you look at your question, say from the point of view of the larger set, you can start drawing tentative answers. And rather than trying to now draw a substantive answer, I would just say that with that framework, that's a framework in which your question and I think the previous question makes sense. But I don't want to go beyond that, and How, I mean, do you, could you, I mean, could you inform?
I believe in observing the universe. Just by observing the universe with open mind, you can see that it's not a random process. You can see that to create intelligent people like here, it can't create by any random, doesn't matter how many billions of years you wait. There must be purpose and intelligence to create all this. That is my observation. I believe quite objective observation. Thanks.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of question time. So there's a 2-minute comfort break, and then we'll be back here for the dialogue with the speakers.